Welcome to the Senate Tax Committee. We are going to hear today about the Tax Expenditures Report. We will have an update on Wisconsin tax reciprocity. I'm happy to be joined here today with Senator Miller, who's visiting us today. Always welcome, Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And it's a great honor to have Commissioner Myron Franz from the Department of Revenue here as well. And he has would like to make a presentation, I think, Commissioner. And so, as always, you are welcome here, and we're happy to see you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And happy birthday, Senator Miller.
Oh, thank you, Commissioner.
Just found out.
Appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity to present today and a department report of some issues that the chair has requested we report on. And I would just want to say at the beginning that what I'm going to be reporting on, really a lot of it is the work of a lot of other people at the department. I was leaving the department last night at 8 o'clock, and I saw about 20 or 30 people working on a special project last night, and I was so impressed by how hard they were working, and the people at the Department of Revenue, I'm just really proud to be a part of that organization and the work that they do. And a lot of what I'm talking about today is really based upon what they're doing, and I'm simply presenting information about that. So I'm really pleased to report on behalf of the Department of Revenue employees. What we'd like to cover today are four basic topic areas. First is the tax reciprocity study and negotiations with Wisconsin, and our website redesign, and then a departmental update on some issues that we're working on that would be of interest to the committee, including tax compliance and also data analytics updates. And then give you an update on what we've been working on in the way of tax reform and how we can work together on that. First of all, in the tax reciprocity overview, tax reciprocity agreements are fairly common in this part of the country. As you can see from the map that I've enclosed, these are the states that we're aware of that have tax reciprocity agreements. So it's something that's done in this part of the country, but not done all around the country. And for those of you who haven't studied this intensely, income tax reciprocity is a formal legal arrangement designed to relieve the burden of filing two state income tax returns for taxpayers who are residents of one state but work in another. Reciprocity agreements allow residents who live in one state and work in another to file returns and pay taxes on income in only the state of residence. Now, we are negotiating as pursuant to the law that was passed last year with a tax reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin. We've entered negotiations, and we're working on that literally as we speak. One of the things we have to do is to define net revenue loss and Wisconsin's willingness to make timely reimbursement payments. The timely reimbursement payments, I think, were sort of the foundation of why Governor Pawlenty and Commissioner Ines felt the need to terminate the agreement several years ago. So we have to make sure we reach those elements of what are timely payments and how can we do it so that no state is out of any revenue. So right now we're working with the Wisconsin Department of Revenue to complete an income tax reciprocity benchmark study in order to investigate or to estimate the magnitude of the reciprocity payment to Minnesota. Let me explain why that's so important. There are about anywhere from 50 to 55,000 taxpayers who live in one state and work in the other, 13 to 15,000 in Minnesota and 35,000 in Wisconsin. And so we have to do a study to determine what happens when one return is filed instead of two. So what we've already agreed with Wisconsin is on our 2011 income tax forms, both states have modified the form to include questions about reciprocity of income on the income tax return. There were identical questions for both Minnesota and Wisconsin, the idea being that we need to know sort of the migration patterns and the payment patterns of the two different states. And obviously it's important for Minnesota because we have more people working in Minnesota who live in Wisconsin. Now, one of the difficulties in doing the benchmark study is tracking this information. The M1CR and the M1NR forms are not scanned into the system, so we have to enter the data from a paper return and put these into a potential reciprocity return in order to study the analyze how these income is going to be reported. So we're going to be setting up these workstations later on, probably beginning in April, Now, the expected completion date will be March 1, 2013. We're using 2011 income tax filing information, so it will be fairly recent, as recent as we can have, and it will help us really determine sort of the magnitude of the issues with Wisconsin. We've recently, as you may know, Wisconsin, the statute in Minnesota required that Wisconsin agreed to fully cooperate, fully participate in the study, and they've agreed to do so. I'd like to talk a little bit about the website redesign. I'll talk a little bit about the mechanics, but I think what's important, the website redesign goes beyond just having a new website, and I'll explain in just a minute. This is the current website that you go to when you see the Minnesota Department of Revenue web location. And we've had a number of complaints that the system is not very intuitive, that it's kind of cluttered with different things to look for, that the search function is not very robust, and it's difficult to locate information and contacts. So here's what the new one is going to look like. We've already designed the basic look of the new website. And as you can see, it's really geared to get people to their location, to their area of interest really quickly for individuals, businesses, tax professionals, and local governments. And you'll notice down below in the first bullet for each one of these four different boxes is the bullet of e-services information. And part of what we want to do there, and I'll talk a little bit more about e-services in a minute, we really want folks to utilize the technology as best they can, because every time we can interact with a taxpayer on the website or through the e-services, we're minimizing the necessary call time, and they can do this 24/7. So it really provides the best flexibility for taxpayers to comply and to get information. You'll notice the third bullet on the for individuals box is where's my refund? And we've been working really hard on that, because that is a really big issue. Because once people file their return, whether it's their income tax return or their property tax refund, they want to know, where is my refund? Now, we know that in many, many cases, we're able to, on an electronic filing of a return, the refund can be made sometimes, many times, less than 1 week. I know that some folks get it within about 3 days. So the refund process is quite efficient on e-filing, but there are a lot of folks who really don't e-file, or they just want to know where the refund is, and they call our lines and they ask, and we really want to try to divert as many of these people to being able to get this information as quickly as possible. The other thing is, you'll notice down a little bit further under individuals is members of the military. We've tried to collect in one location all the different benefits for veterans and military folks so that they don't have to hunt around for everything. They can find it, they know where it is, and we're trying also to make sure we have some people at the Department of Revenue who are really specialists in this area, because it can be confusing for members of the military. If you'll notice on the for business category, another thing, we've listed some of the primary tax types that people look at a lot, the sales and use tax, withholding tax, but we really also want to make sure down below you see starting a business. We're really trying to do what we can to be business friendly, especially for the small business folks who are starting a business, who are just getting underway. How do they get started? How do they file their income taxes? And part of what we want to do is we're working with other agencies to make sure that they also know that they need to go to Deed to look at a potential grant, or they need to go to the Department of Labor and Industry for any forms there. They need to go to the Secretary of State to file their incorporation documents if that's necessary. So the key here is making sure that once we get a taxpayer who's starting a new business, that we help them find all the things they need to do as part of their business opportunity. So this is sort of the look of the new website. In terms of the goals, we obviously wanted to have a more simple navigation system. We wanted to incorporate some intuitive menu labels, like the four different buckets for the taxpayer types. We want to continually update the content in plain language. It doesn't help us to take the existing language that we have in the current website or in our current notices and just push that into a website. We really need to write it in a way that makes more sense, and I'll get to that in just a minute. We've enhanced the search functionality, and we think overall it will just have a better look and feel going forward. So here's the time schedule. We launched the beta website and completed the last formalized usability testing. Now, the usability users have included individual taxpayers, businesses, tax professionals, representatives of local units of government, tax researchers, DOR employees, and legislative staff. Now, based on the feedback that we've been getting, we anticipate launching the new webpage on May 1, 2012. Now, we just want to highlight the fact that obviously it'll never be finished, and we have built in and incorporated several ways to continue getting feedback from taxpayers and users to make sure that we keep making the system better. I mean, even, you know, we've heard about last fall's launch by Target of a new product line, and they had their system crash. I mean, whenever you change things and add new functionality and ideas, things can happen, and you really want to be careful, and you want to try to be ready for that as much as possible. But we're really excited about this website redesign. We think it will help move people from calling to the website. Now, the plain language project, as I mentioned, is not just for the website redesign. We're looking at this throughout the department. One of the things that I think we all know is that citizens, taxpayers complain sometimes about not being able to understand notices or taxpayer regulations. So we're trying very desperately to do what we can. And just one example here I think is instructive. Right now, the question says, can I make payment arrangements on the amount I owe? And we've changed that to, are payment plans available? But I think the answer is particularly instructive. The current answer is, the Minnesota Department of Revenue may accept installment arrangements on past due tax liability or debt. Well, the answer really is yes. And so we've tried to change that to yes if you can't pay in full right now. So those are some of the ways that we're trying to chop things down, make them simple, make them direct, so taxpayers can really look at this and make sense. So we're doing this not just on the website, on notices, on regulations, whatever we can. Now, sometimes, obviously, we have legal requirements and legal definitions we have to put on there. But in many cases, we can make it more simple, at least the explanation. I'd like to now go to some departmental updates. Voluntary compliance is really the key to what we do. Now, I know in this committee and in other committees, we talk about audits and examinations and compliance initiatives, but you know, well over 90% of all the revenue that we bring in is voluntary compliance by taxpayers. And so we think the future for the department is to make sure that we enhance and develop technology that helps make that a better process for the taxpayers. And this, I think it's important to give credit for the Paulini administration for enhancing and in investing in the data tax integration system that we now have. It's been over a 4-year project in implementing this new integrated tax system. But it's important that we don't just keep it for ourselves in the Department of Revenue. It's really important that we figure out ways so that the citizens and the taxpayers can interact with the Department of Revenue using that technology to access their information. So one of the things we're trying to do is we're looking any way we can to increase efficiency. And I'm proud to report that this last fall, the Minnesota Department of Revenue was given an award by Governor Dayton for a Better Government Award for Better Minnesota. What we did in terms of the department, there was a team put together. We were processing a lot of paper checks. And as you can imagine, processing paper checks takes a lot of time. Well, in order to really do it more effectively, we would have had to invest in another $1 million in cost to keep that going. This team put together a way to convert to electronic check processing. We saved $1 million in equipment, and we're saving over $100,000 each year in that process. And we're taking that new process, and we're showing other departments around the state how they can also enhance their check processing return. So this is just one example of how we're trying to make sure that we really return good value for the taxpayers.
Commissioner?
Yes.
Excuse me. I know that the department has made a huge effort at providing great customer service, and I think the efficiencies are great and the award as well. But I would ask if we could maybe turn to the tax analytics issue. We are pressed for time. We have to be done at 10 o'clock. We also have the tax expenditures report. So if we could maybe turn to that. I know folks here at the table are interested in what happened with the tax analytics and with the tax compliance initiative.
Let's do it. No, that's easy. We'll go through that.
Thank you.
This was just explaining
Madam
how
Chair.
We're using e-services to incorporate.
Excuse me, Commissioner. Senator Miller.
I have one quick question before I have to go to the Jobs Committee. Thank you, Madam Chair. On the income tax reciprocity, Commissioner, do you see that being in place January of 2013, your best guess at this point?
Commissioner Frank.
Chair, Senator, we do not see it in place in January 1, 2013, unless we can come to some preliminary agreement. The study won't be completed in time to do that. So we would have to implement an agreement without a full understanding of the nuances between the taxpayer, the revenue situation in both states. It's something that could be done, but we would advise against it simply because we won't have the numbers from the study at that time.
Well, Commissioner, I'm sure not just Senator Miller, but all of us would like you to do all in your power, even if maybe some of it is difficult to do, to make that effective January 1, 2013. We have a lot of residents here and residents in Wisconsin that are greatly impacted by that. So I hope you'll go back and look again and see if there isn't something we can do to put that in place. Senator Miller, other comments on
No,
that?
That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, Senator, Madam, thank you. We'll take
Senator
your comment.
Bob.
Madam Chair, to help Senator Miller understand how we got there, Governor Plante's the one that terminated the reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin. So let's all be clear.
Senator Bach, Commissioner Franz said that earlier today. Commissioner, if you could begin with the tax analytics, we would appreciate it.
Here we go. The tax analytics. So one of the things that let me talk about the tax compliance initiative first, and then I'll go in terms of how tax analytics is fitting into that. As you know, Madam Chair, the department has been issued a directive to increase its compliance and generate an additional $82.3 million in this biennium. Now, I just want to be clear, we're off to a slow start, and this often happens with new initiatives, and it takes a while to get the people on board and get them going on audits and whatever. So we're doing what we can to try to pick up the pace and make that work. But we're now going back to tax analytics. One of the things that we want to do and are trying to do as quickly as possible also is to make sure we use tax analytics as part of that process. As Madam Chair knows, we started this process with a solicitation notice back in April, and we've been going through the process of getting proposals. I think it's fair to say that when you get down to the master contracts were finally agreed upon and signed in November with the Department of Administration, which gave us the opportunity then to engage the contractors on a regular basis. So what we're doing now is we've got an analytics steering team to figure out how we can use the analytics within the department. We've got analytics training and educational systems set up for DOR staff. We're trying to make sure we've looked at other states. One of the things that's really important to do for us is to not recreate the wheel, something that's already been done. So we've talked to other states. We've conducted research. So one of the things that, and we're looking at the number of different projects that we can use vendors for, and I'll give you the vendor list next, but one of the things we've initially decided is that we've got three major areas that we can use data analytics to help, and the first one is return processing. We believe that the new analytics offers some opportunity to really select returns for review prior to refund distribution to make sure we prevent fraud in refund situations. We also think that we can use data analytics for audit selection criteria and to look at different ways of doing things that we're not doing today. And also we want to try to use analytics to make our current selection more efficient and effective. These are the number of folks who have signed a master contract with the Department of Administration, and we've made contact with all of these vendors, and we're actually in the proof of concept phase with several of these different vendors to try to figure out, can their product really work? Because we've got to make sure, the key here is making sure that their product is different than what we would do and it adds value, so we're not paying for something we're not doing anyway. But we're working on that, and I'm hopeful that within the next several months we'll be able to finish several proof of concepts, actually engage some of these folks and move forward, because it's critical that we get these new analytics involved as soon as possible in the process. Why don't I do this? Let me do the other operational updates, and then I'll finish on the tax reform process so we can keep things moving along. Just on the horizon going forward, we're trying to make sure that we expand e-services for businesses. We want to enhance e-services for individuals. We want to have quality tools for taxpayer phone calls. As you know, there are going to be folks who use the phone and do paper filing for years to come, and we've got to provide them a service. We've got to make sure they get to a person that knows what's going on. That's the key to successful service calls. We've also instituted a process where we can give payment reminders and filing reminders. It's not that we want to do the taxpayer's job, but there are small businesses out there that a little reminder could really help, because people really do want to comply generally, and if we can help in that way, we want to. Electronic payments are really important, because if we can make that process work and let taxpayers know when it's not working, then they can make the correction and we don't have to send them a paper filing. Well, let me finish on the last topic that the committee was interested in. That's our tax reform effort. And one of the things that we've done is we've tried to spend some time talking to Minnesotans and legislators and officials, business groups, and we're trying to get their view of tax reform. I can truthfully say that our tax reform proposal is right here. It's a blank page. We're really starting from scratch. We want to hear from people. We've been to 13 cities already. We've had over 26 meetings. We've had 14 legislators join us so far in the different meetings. We've talked to almost 1,400 people. And we have one advisory group that I'll describe in just a minute. Here are the 13 cities that we've been to, and these are the groups that we've been talking to. Obviously, we're kind of an open book. If you call and want us to talk to you or give us a presentation, we're happy to do so. The topics that we've been talking about to the different groups, we've been talking about the changing demographics in Minnesota, the changing economy from a manufacturing economy to a service economy, the e-commerce problem, and I should mention the jobs. We all know that when jobs go down, we lose revenue, and jobs is the key way to try to grow out of any deficit problem. We've talked about the shifting mix of taxes. We've talked about who pays in this process, the complexity issues, and the tax expenditures that you're going to hear Dr. Paul Wilson talk about, which is a continual problem that we need to address. But we also talk about tax reform values. What are our values now? And we talk about being more fair, more simple, and promoting economic growth. I'm sure we can all agree with those in general, but the question is, what does that mean for everybody, and how can we talk about that in a way that makes sense? This is the list of the next meetings that we have scheduled thus far, but I want to offer to all of the members an opportunity to come to your area or speak to any group you're interested in, that we can talk, and it's been really helpful to have legislators attend these meetings for the citizens to see the administration and the legislators talking together about what can we do, what are your ideas to make the system work more effectively. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm ready to turn the testimony over to Dr. Paul Wilson if you're ready to move on. Do you have any questions?
Commissioner, we may have a question or two. Can you tell me about the governor's LGA group? And can you explain why the governor felt it necessary? We do have a legislative appointed group working on the same issue, so why do we need a second one, Commissioner?
Good question, Madam Chair. First of all, we will look very closely at what the legislative group is doing.
And in fact, some of the members are the same, right?
Exactly, yes. The reason we wanted to implement a different group was we wanted to sort of speed up some issues and get some folks from some different parts of the state to meet on a regular basis with us in the department to give us more concrete information from their point of view on the ground, what's working in their cities and what's not working. So it's a complement or supplement to what the legislative group is doing, and we felt the need to try to hurry that pace up a little bit more, and that's why we decided to implement the advisory group to facilitate that discussion.
Commissioner, is a report due before January
2013? They're not going to make a report. They're an advisory group to the governor, and the governor's plan is to prepare a proposal for this legislature for 2013. So our finished product is not a report per se. It's really a proposal for you and this committee to consider, and obviously the House to consider. So we have an action plan. That action plan is to present this group and the House with an action plan for tax reform.
Commissioner, I would appreciate your cooperation with our group and sharing information and all that you learn with them. I mean, the more people that are engaged in this conversation about LGA, the better, because it affects so many Minnesotans on so many different levels. So I hope that you'll include them in all the information that you share and vice versa. I will make the same comment to them that the more hands at this, the easier the lifting, I think.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I appreciate that offer. One of the things that I've been able to do is look at some of the past commissions. We've had a few commissions and studies over the years, and as you dust some of those off and look at them, there are a lot of good ideas in there. And with the group that the legislative group that you mentioned and our advisory group, we need to sort of take a look at that and those good ideas, and are they still good today? Do they need to be changed? And we will gladly share information.
Commissioner, one other thing. The governor has had a press conference talking about some legislative initiatives and saying that he maybe, you know, mistakenly said that there were bills or legislation. We've not seen anything. So I'm wondering when we might see bills related to the material presented at the press conference.
Madam Chair, I believe the bill was introduced maybe today or yesterday in the Senate. It was jacketed and being introduced, so I think it's been introduced.
Senator Skoy?
Yes, I dropped the jackets in yesterday during session.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Senator Skoy and Commissioner Franz. And we are going to talk about tax expenditures, and perhaps you don't want to get into the discussion today, but the tax credits that you're proposing or the governor is proposing for hiring employees would fall right into the category of tax expenditures, which we have discussed is a concern. And I'm wondering at some point if you would please be willing to come back and talk about why you and the governor believe we should add to the tax expenditures by doing yet another tax credit. And as I said, you don't have to answer today if you don't like, but I do hope that you will address that question in the future.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd be glad to answer it actually right now. Right. I think it's important. No, you raise a good point. And any good tax reform or any good analysis of tax expenditures makes you wonder about adding to that list. And the reason we targeted the Jobs Now credit was we targeted it for specific groups for a specific time, and it expires on June 30th, 2013. We believe that if you're going to engage in direct tax expenditures for a particular reason, and we think there's a good reason now because of the economy and the jobs, that you've got to do it, you've got to be targeted, and you need to end it. So the idea was let's study it, let's see how it worked before we let it go on. So we appreciate your concern, and we were concerned likewise about that issue, but we felt that the economy necessitated some dramatic action.
All right, well, we will look forward to an additional conversation about that, and I will look forward to looking at Senator Skoy's bill. And we will give that bill a hearing at some point, Senator Skoy, whenever you're ready. Senator Chamberlain, did you have a question or a comment?
No, I'll pass. We'll wait. Thank you.
Others? Commissioner, thank you so much for coming today. We always love to talk taxes here in the Tax Committee, so you're always welcome.
Thank you very much. I appreciate
thank you.
It.
And
thank
you said Dr. Wilson is going to speak to the tax expenditures?
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Wilson, welcome to the committee. Whenever stuff. You're ready, you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm not doing as well at multitasking, so I'll get this up and then start.
Take your time whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be back to talk again about tax expenditures. You did have a hearing last year on tax expenditures, even though there wasn't a new report out. And since I'm sure you all remember everything that was said then, but I will try to say some different things today. There also was a Tax Expenditure Review Commission report that came out last year, and you again had a hearing on that. So you've heard a lot about tax expenditures. And I'll try to take a little different tack today in what I cover and try to leave time as well for questions.
Great.
At the end. So, again, as we've noted before, this is the 13th, this is a mandated study. This is the 13th edition of the study, issued on February 1st on time, despite a lot of worry about being on time this year. Due February 1st of every even-numbered year. It's a major project. First study, by the way, went back to 1985, so this is an old study. It's been around a long time. It's a major project, includes estimates for 307 separate items this year, and within those items, there are often many sub-items. We have about 12 analysts who have contributed parts of this, plus two summer interns, or two interns in the spring and summer, I guess, all led by Caroline Carlson in our office, who, without whom this report basically would not get done. So thanks to her. Most of the work is done in the summer and the fall. So some of this is not done after the November forecast. There are some parts of it that are based on the November forecast, but realize this is done over time, so it's a little everything doesn't get updated in that way. I want to do three things today. I want to talk about tax expenditure as a concept quickly. What is a tax expenditure, and address a couple questions that always come up about whether this is, in fact, there's some bias involved in talking about tax expenditure, whether this is a sort of an ideological issue. I want to at least focus on that a little bit. Then I want to look at very quickly an example from the study, just run through what is shown for an item in the study. And then I want to spend most of the time on uses of the tax expenditure budget. What is this good for? How do you use it? And I want to provide some cautions, basically, in the use. I think that sometimes people are too quick to jump in and grab a number from here, and so I think it's important for us to realize how useful this can be, but also some of the limitations of that as well. And I want to look at the uses from three perspectives. One is a budgeting perspective, a tax reform perspective, and then a revenue options perspective, which is a nice way of saying a menu of possible tax increases. And all three perspectives have some validity, but I want to look at each of them separately. Tax expenditure is a concept. Again, the idea of a tax expenditure is just that if the only goal of a tax system was to raise money, raise revenue, almost everybody just generally agrees you should have a broad tax base and a low rate. So a broad tax base and a low rate is almost a mantra among tax policy experts. And so that's the starting point of the idea of a tax expenditure. You start by saying low tax, broad base, but then you want to do other things. So we want to encourage homeownership, so you have a home mortgage interest deduction. You want to recognize and reward combat veterans, and so you have a combat credit. You want to help farmers pay for bovine TB testing, so we add a bovine TB credit. You want to help low-income families pay for child care, so we have a refundable child care credit at the state level. We want to increase business startups, so we add an angel investment credit. We want to help local governments, so you have exempt interest in local bonds, so that the interest rates that they pay on the bonds can be lower. All of these are, in some sense, exceptions to accomplish a purpose. And all of the purposes can be justified as purposes. But people who look at this as a tax expenditure and think of these things as tax expenditures, the second point is that each of these could be designed as a direct expenditure program to meet the same goals. We have a lot of programs out there to encourage homeownership, to help homeowners get into housing. Housing Finance Agency does quite a bit of work in this area. We certainly, in the combat veteran, this is $120 per month for people per month they serve in the combat zone. The Veterans Department here could easily write those checks to people. They know who the people are. It doesn't have to run through the tax system. It could be a direct expenditure program. Bovine TB testing could be paid for by the Ag Department or subsidized by the Ag Department or shared costs by the Ag Department. Helping pay child care, we have a basic siding fee program to target the same group that the tax credit targets. Angel investment credit, when that was enacted, there was a lot of discussion about maybe making it a matching grant program. It's basically administered by deed. Deed tells people what they qualify for, and then they're told to put on the tax return. Deed could, in fact, do this as a direct appropriation program and simply send the money. And there are other ways to help local governments, of course, besides keeping interest rates low on borrowing that those businesses do. So each of these has a purpose. It's run through the tax system, but they look a lot like an expenditure. And so that's the idea of a tax expenditure. The difference, though, between a tax expenditure and a direct expenditure is in the budgeting process. And this is what the tax expenditure review report focused on. The difference between a tax expenditure and direct expenditure is tax expenditure has no direct line in the budget. If it weren't for this report, nobody would know the number. It doesn't show up in budget documents. There's no regular review process, or at least less review of tax expenditures than there is of direct expenditures. I'm not saying all direct expenditures get reviewed in quite the way that you might wish, but there's even less review for most tax expenditures. There's generally no limit on growth. They grow over time, and nobody says, oh, that's growing too fast, let's cut it back. So we cut back the basic sliding fee, child care, but the child care credit doesn't have a limit on it. So basically, things can grow without the same kind of attention to growth as you have in the budget. They're authorized by different committees, which makes it difficult. You look at the home mortgage interest deduction, housing, other committees look at housing issues generally, and integrating the two is difficult in the political process. There's more limited public information because most tax data is confidential, and so it's very difficult to have that information for people to know who's getting benefits from things, whereas direct programs, you tend to have more direct information. It's not confidential the same way.
Doctor, I'm very sorry to interrupt you. You just said, I think, that the tax expenditures can be authorized by other committees, but I believe, in fact, they all come here to the tax committee at some point, or have been to the tax committee at some point, because they're tax in nature, correct?
Madam Chair, if I said that, I didn't mean to. I was saying that housing, direct expenditure programs for housing are done through a different committee. And if they have the same, some of the same sort of overlap in purpose from something like a mortgage interest deduction or other housing deductions, the same, it's hard to get the tax expenditures lined up with the direct expenditures because different committees do the authorization.
Right, so theirs would be included in their budget. But if it were authorized as a tax expenditure, it would actually come here to the committee. And so your point is we may be trying to address the same concern with a budget item and also a tax expenditure,
right,
and that we should be looking to see if that's occurring, or it's a way to it might be a good idea to do.
I think that's at least the message of those who talk about tax expenditures and push the idea.
Thank you.
The big difference, of course, as you all know, is that a tax expenditure, if you vote for a tax expenditure, you're voting for a tax decrease. If you vote for a program that does exactly the same thing but does it through a direct expenditure, it's an increase in government spending. And you all know that everybody who has a new idea about how to spend money, the first question a lobbyist should ask is, can we do that as a tax credit somehow? If we could do it as a tax credit, then it would be viewed as a tax cut.
Madam Chair.
It would be easier to enact.
Senator Rust.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Wilson. I think most of us are more commonly would call the other, what you're calling a direct expenditure, we call an appropriation. And
that's correct.
And we think of those things in the finance committee, and then we call what the tax committee does a tax expenditure.
That's correct.
We just maybe we use it more commonly. You are in the habit of, maybe we shouldn't, but we're in the habit of using the word appropriation to define the difference.
Senator, I think that's correct. St. Paul language, isn't there? We don't necessarily speak the same language as the people in our districts, or even with
even the Department of Revenue.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's what might have been confusing a little
bit. Senator Bach, did you have?
I think the parallel between having expenditure in both terms, so direct expenditure and tax expenditure, makes them seem more parallel than appropriation and direct and tax expenditure, but you're exactly right. It's appropriation and direct expenditure is what mean the same thing. Just want to take one moment to just address the question of bias, because is this a tax expenditure, is it a tax loophole, or is it tax relief? And tax expenditure is designed to be a neutral term. It really is. It's designed to be a neutral term. In our committee, in our group of six people that put out the budget for the Tax Expenditure Review Commission, we had people all the way from John Spry to Jay Kudrowski, and I don't know where some of the others are on the political spectrum, and they all agree that tax expenditure is a good way to define things. The best example of using tax expenditures is President Reagan in the tax reform. I was in Washington, D.C., working at Treasury at that point, and we were told, look at every tax expenditure and review it and decide if it should be kept. And that was how tax reform was done. So tax expenditure idea has been used by conservatives, and it is tax relief, and some of them may be tax loopholes, but tax expenditure is meant to be a non-pejorative term rather than a than sort of a it's just sort of meant to say, look, it's this, but we're not going to call it bad or good by trying to define it, use a term that has some other connotations. And again, the fair tax is a very broad-based sales tax at the federal level. You've heard of that proposal, broader-based. They actually have some things we don't even have in the tax expenditure budget. And I have a quote here from Martin Feldstein, who's a very conservative economist, often cited by conservatives for his views on tax policy. And he, again, I just want to emphasize that the idea of tax expenditure as a starting point, not that everything that's listed there is bad, but as a starting point is something that's broadly sort of broadly accepted across the spectrum, but not by everybody, and I realize that. And the fact that people tend to look at tax expenditure budget as a menu for tax increases, I realize, makes some people skeptical of the use of the poor. I want to come back to that in a second. The report includes all taxes that we collect just about. Minnesota Care we still don't have in there because we're not quite sure how to define the base and exceptions to it. But I want to emphasize it's all taxes, but I'm going to talk today really about income, sales, and corporate in my final comments here. So I wanted to show you one page from the report. This is from page 61 of the report. And I just want to sort of describe again what's in the report and then what is it. Okay. This is home mortgage interest. The first thing each of these shows is a legal citation. Where is it in the law? And then we describe the current law in very brief terms. In this case, it makes it clear that a second home, mortgage interest deduction on a second home is deductible, but not a third. That there are some limits on the item deduction, so there's some description of what current law is. There's a little bit of history. Again, these are very brief, but sometimes they try to in a very short kernel, summarize what we think is the most important elements of the history. If we know the number affected, that's mentioned, but in most cases we don't have estimates of the number affected. Income tax models runs we tend to, but other things we don't tend to. And then the dollar impact. And the dollar impact here of in 2012 of $341.6 million would mean that that's how much benefit, that's the amount of tax relief granted by this tax expenditure. It's also how much would be raised roughly if you got rid of and repealed that tax expenditure. There's always some feel for how big is that number. I said last time you could look at this as how much could you reduce the rates if you repealed this item, how much higher in some sense does it keep the rates. And in this case, since we know each tenth of a percentage point change in all three income tax rates costs about 100, if you reduce revenue about $119 million, you could say that, and again, I'm not picking on this particular one, but just as an example, you could say this is about 0.25% tax rate change. So we could lower the 5.35 to 5.1, 7.05 to 6.8, 7.85% rate to 7.6. That's how big this is. If you got rid of this, you could lower the rates, all three of them, by 0.25%. Now, you wouldn't necessarily want to do that, but it's just to give a feel for how big these things are. It's sometimes better to think about the tax reduction that is equivalent to that amount of money that could be done.
Dr. Wilson, another example in this category would be something like Social Security payments. When the federal government makes Social Security payments, the state has chosen not to tax that as income. I think that's the kind of thing where you get into difficult territory. It'd be very complex for us to redefine what is income different from what the federal government defines as income. Isn't that right?
Madam Chair, that's correct, and I will hit that point pretty hard in just a minute when we talk about the tax reform perspective, because I think there are quite a few tax managers here where that's exactly a big problem, and these may not really be administrable at the state level. And so it's a very, very good point, and I'll come back and hit it again.
And I do hope that you will spend some time on that, because mm-hmm. I think there is a misperception that it would be possible to eliminate the entire tax expenditure budget, and for the most part, that's really not true. But I hope you'll talk about that.
Madam Chair, that's one of the messages I want to put later on. I have in here later on.
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, Dr. Wilson, the mortgage interest deduction is a federal conformity issue. Of the $11 billion of tax expenditures on an annual basis, if we only did federal conformity and looked at all the tax expenditures that are unique to Minnesota's tax code, what does the $11 billion number become?
Dr. Wilson.
I actually don't have that. I've not calculated that number, but you can get it because the way the tax expenditure budget is organized, it starts with federal exclusions, federal deductions, which are the conformity ones, and then everything that's a Minnesota subtraction, Minnesota credit, or Minnesota special rule, all of those sections would be Minnesota specific. But I would say that I think my point would be that federal conformity sometimes we do federal conformity for simplicity, and some federal conformity is really important for simplicity and some is not so important. And it would not be difficult for us, again, I'm not saying you would want to do this, but it would not be difficult for us to disconnect from the mortgage interest deduction because it's a line on the federal return. So we know the number, and you can add it back. Wisconsin, about half the states have disconnected from the mortgage interest deduction on their income tax. So some things are easier to disconnect from and are not that complicated to disconnect from. Other things are very difficult to disconnect from. And so not all federal conformity is sort of equal in terms of the complexity. But, I mean, I think your question is right. We could look at that. I could get you an answer for how much is just Minnesota specific.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that might be helpful. I mean, the spending committees always talk about all the money that's spent in the tax committee, $11 billion in this case, just on expenditures. I think it might be helpful for the committee to know how much of it is just related to federal conformity and how much were actually decisions made here that are unique to our state. This might be helpful information if you could get that.
Okay. Senator Bach, I agree. I hope that you will come back. I think people are very interested in this subject. And I think if you get to whether it's easy or not to disconnect from the federal, is it a second level of analysis? But the first one is if you accept the concept of the goal of conformity, which I think most of us do here, let's look at that and then maybe separate it out that way and we can review it. And I would love to have that. We would love to hear it back in this committee. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, Dr. Wilson, in regards to the suggestion of whether it's a federal conformity issue or not, I'm wondering about the rationale or what the issue was that we were addressing on it. You know, I know it says in here how many people benefit from the tax, but what kind of behavior were we looking at trying to drive with that with this tax expenditure?
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I think it's interesting, and one of the things that's not on here is there's no purpose.
Right.
We don't list a purpose. Usually people think of the home mortgage interest deduction as something to encourage home ownership.
Right.
That's how I would describe it. Right. However, if you look at how the benefits are distributed, I think most economists would say it does a lot to increase the consumption of housing to make people, give an incentive to buy bigger houses and larger houses and more expensive houses much more than to actually make the decision between renting and home ownership. It has an effect there, but because a lot of the benefits go to people who would be homeowners anyway, it's not clear what – but anyway, maybe the purpose is just to expand the demand for housing.
Right.
If that's the purpose, it would be different. But there is no statement of purpose here because we're not sure what the purpose is, actually.
Well, Senator Howe, if you remember the report we received last year, the group recommended a criteria for reviewing expenditures,
right.
And you might want to look at that report again.
Sure.
Senator Howe.
Well, Madam Chair, I was just – when we do something, there's an argument given – when we do it, and what was the argument? Is it a valid argument now or not? And, I mean, everybody has their rationale for why we think this is a good expenditure or not, but I'd like to know if there's some history to why we started down that road. That was my question.
Senator Bob?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Howe, it's never quite that simple. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at this here and you think, well, home mortgage interest deduction, that's pretty straightforward, but it includes second home interest. Okay. So it's about more than just primary residences because your mortgage interest on your cabin is also deductible. So there's always more than what you see.
Well, and Senator Bach, that's exactly what the group said, is we should be looking at them, identify the purpose, see if we're actually accomplishing the goals. And it's not going to be, I mean, we're going to have to do a little bit of the research on that, too, to go back and try and figure out what the initial purposes were. Senator Rust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Wilson, I would also be interested in the number of non-itemizers who are homeowners. And what has the trend been in that? I mean, with holding inflation steady or whatever, are people continuing to own homes who don't have enough income even to take advantage of the mortgage interest deduction because they don't meet the threshold for itemizing?
We say here 730,000 about benefit from the deduction. Now it may not be much of a benefit in some cases, but it's some benefit. We do know about how many homeowners there are, so, and I don't actually know what that number is, but we know how many homesteads there are in Minnesota. That's a number that's known, and so the ratio of these two would give you two. Clearly, a lot of older homeowners don't itemize because you paid off your mortgage, and that's where it drives
yeah,
itemizing
paid
more
off
than anything else.
For one
so,
thing. Right.
So you have a lot of people who are non-itemizers who are itemized.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, as we have this discussion, maybe I'm a little more cynical than some, but I kind of look at the expenditure problem, the tax expenditure issue, and the deductions that we've managed to collect over the years as being more a product of a political factor that we may have some issues in our home district, and we all agree, and so what we do is we create a little token to go back to the kind of the people that have been rattling the cage a little bit, and so we create an expenditure that they can deduct. And as a result, we then, as a state, have to manage our financial affairs on the adjusted revenue stream after we give them their adjustments. I think we really have gotten to the point where we've had a long, long history of not wanting to address the basic reform, foundational reforms that are necessary in the state. And so what we have done is collected this myriad of deductions that are primarily for political purpose. Now, we could look at it and say there's $11 billion of money that we in the tax committee are spending. Or we could look at it and say, why don't we just reduce the overall taxation in the state of Minnesota by $11 billion and not have this whole thing and maybe start fresh again. But that may be a little too extreme for some, too, because there's people here that think we don't spend enough. And that's all for debate. But I think we kind of get to the point now that we're tightening a belt a little bit as a result of deficits, we're now looking at this again. But I think it would be important to kind of stand back and get a wider perspective on it and ask ourselves, is it time for Minnesota to maybe have a major tax reform? And, you know, we can banter back and forth on the political extremes, but I think that discussion really is timely for this time now.
Madam Chair. Senator Vest. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Wilsonite, in trying to understand this particular tax expenditure, I would also be interested in knowing how many taxpayers become itemizers because of the expenses of home ownership, including not only mortgage interest, but also the deduction for property taxes. It would seem to me that that's the big, that would be the primary reason a typical family, let's say, or a typical homeowner would become an itemizer on their federal return and then obviously on their state return as well. And can you figure out also how many people do not add back in their property tax refund as a reduction or as a an add back to the deduction that they got on their federal reform, on their federal form?
Madam Chair, are you a tax preparer?
I'm retired.
Madam Chair, Senator Russ, there's that certainly is an issue that the Department of Revenue has the ability to look at, but I'm not.
Do you audit on that, Madam Chair, Dr. Wilson?
I know very little about auditing in the Department of Revenue, so I'm not the right person to ask. Eric Ouellette might have an answer for that, since he's in the property tax division, but we don't. I do so little in property tax now that that it's not an area.
Just curious.
I'm familiar with. But it's a good question and one the department should be addressing.
Madam Chair,
Senator Bach.
To Senator Limmer's point about tackling the tax expenditure issue, I was intrigued the other day when I saw an ad on television from the wind industry that said, call your member of Congress and tell them to not put a new tax on wind production. And what I knew of the truth about that was there's a federal tax credit for wind production, and the Congress is looking at taking it away. But it's being teed up by the interest group as it's an increase in taxes on the industry when that's really not true. It's credit like an expenditure. So the challenge, Senator Limmer, going forward is all the interest groups are going to view it as a tax increase, and that's how it's going to be portrayed by a lot of people. And I saw it on TV the other day.
Thank you. Dr. Wilson, would you go forward? And we really are interested in some of the complexity issues and the reason for caution, because I think there's a general assumption that we could just eliminate these expenditures and altogether, but we really can't, and at least for the most part. So will you move on to that? We spent a lot of time last year on the review process, but maybe you can give us your insight into why maybe this is more complicated than meets the eye.
I would say there's one way to look at tax expenditures, which we've got the review commission, which is to sort of look at evaluating them on a one-by-one basis. And that's the budgeting perspective. Try to bring it into the budget process in terms of that. But I think what you're asking about is a little bit more of the tax reform perspective, so we can move directly on to that. Tax reform perspective basically says let's look at all the tax expenditures. Your usual starting point here, as it's been described, you take all the tax expenditures and the income tax, and you say, wow, look how big they are, and how much should we lower the rate if we got rid of all of them? And that's sort of the starting point. And that at the federal level, that's not a bad starting point. I really want to emphasize that if you're looking at tax reform at the federal level, everything can be on the table because they can change reporting requirements. They can make changes. Our problem is that a state tax policy, we have a hard time administering things separate from the federal in many cases. So I've got three reasons for caution and sort of in the process of just adding up totals and looking at that. In terms of looking at tax reform. The first one is, as the chair has mentioned, that even though most tax expenditures increase complexity somewhat, at least for tax administration and often for taxpayers, there are some tax expenditures which actually significantly, if you repealed some tax expenditures, you actually would increase complexity. It would be the opposite. Minnesota piggybacks on many of the federal provisions that affect the timing of taxes. And one of the things that the department always says when we come here for the federal update is if it has to do with depreciation, if it has to do with anything like that, if it has to do with IRAs and the way you got to update, because we don't want to try to administer these things separately because they affect the timing, and you got to keep separate sets of books out of over many years if we disconnect from the feds. Now, we disconnected as a state from the federal depreciation schedule in the early 1980s, and it took a while to unwind that, but some things are very tough to disconnect from, and yet they're in the tax expenditure budget as a tax expenditure because they really are, but it would be very difficult for us going alone to disconnect from some of those. So decoupling from federal law would require keeping two sets of books, and again, I've got some examples there. That's one problem, timing issues. Timing issues where we differ from the Fed on timing issues are problematic. That's probably the biggest problem with federal decoupling that we would have. There are also some areas, some tax expenditures, which would create compliance problems. And you want to think here of federal exclusions, things that are excluded from income and never show up on a tax reform on the tax form at all. If it's not taxed federally, and if it's not reported anywhere in the federal return, and if it's not subject to federal reporting requirements for some other reason that we can get the reporting requirements, the taxpayer themselves may not know the amount that should be put there, and certainly the DOR will struggle with compliance. So a lot of employee fringe benefits, they're listed in the book as tax expenditures, and the federal government could, in fact, tax that stuff, and if they did, we could join them. But it'd be very difficult for us to go out alone on some of those because they are not reported on the W-2, and again, not all our employers are going to just voluntarily sort of start reporting stuff for us because we've got multi-state employers. And it's not that it couldn't be done, but it's just difficult. And I think it's important just to realize these are both difficulties. Neither one says you can never decouple from this stuff, but it says be aware of the limitations, be aware of the difficulty here of our actually having information or the taxpayer having information to actually complete the form. And the third caution, the three cautions, one is the timing, the second is informational problems, particularly with federal exclusions. And the third is, and by the way, with the federal exclusions, anything that appears in the tax return, we can decouple from administratively without much trouble. So if it's a line in the form, like the mortgage interest deduction, we can decouple from that. That's not an administrative problem, maybe a political problem. It's not an administrative problem to decouple from. That's big. It would be a little more complicated, but it's not a big administrative problem like some of these others would be. The third caution is just you can't really add these things up. And I gave this example last time. If you add up each of the tax expenditures for each of the six itemized deductions in the report, you get $766 million in fiscal year, I think it's 2012. I'm not sure which fiscal year it is. Anyway, you get $766 million. But if you actually got rid of all of them, you'd only get $521 million. And that's because as you start getting rid of itemized deductions, people switch to becoming non-itemizers and taking the standard deduction. And so you can't pick up more money. But if each one, when you do it first, and the tax expenditure body looks at doing each one first, they all will gain more if you do them first than when you do other ones ahead of them. And so you can't add everything up. And this is the biggest area, but that's why we really don't have totals in the tax expenditure budget. We're so wary of these interactions that we really don't like to put totals. Nevertheless, here are some totals. Okay. Having said that, I give. Okay. Tax expenditures, you'll see the asterisk on the tax expenditure line there. That asterisk says we have adjusted for interactions among itemized deductions because they're so big. And if you do that, you get a total tax expenditures of $4.7 billion in the income tax. You just add up the totals. This is fiscal year 13. The number in blue at the bottom, $8.3 billion, that's total income tax collections expected that year. So that's our net revenue. Our tax expenditures are 4.7. The number at the top, and some people are very wary of this, I'm putting it out here because the Tax Expenditure Review Commission, Review Study Group really wanted this done. If you add those two together, you get 12.9 or 13 billion. In some sense, if you didn't have any tax expenditures, and you sort of add these up, you got 13 billion. We give, in some sense, quote, give away 4.7 billion to get down to the 8.3 billion. It's a way to think about this. And so the tax expenditures are pretty big. Compared to collections, 57% of collections. So the tax expenditures are as big as 57% of what we get, if you look at all of them. But to get to Chair Erdman's point here, some of these I have listed here, repeal would pose fewer or no administrative problems because it's a line in the form, it's not timing, or it's a Minnesota provision that we could easily change ourselves. We're complicating things all by ourselves. If you look at only those, they only come up to 17% of collections. Now, that's not to say none of the others could be done, but I think it really is a big difference because in the personal income tax, timing issues are a lot of the numbers in here. And some of the others, like fringe benefits, are very big, but they are, in fact, tough to administer if we go it alone. And again, I'm not saying it's impossible. I just say you really got to think about the administrative problems on the other ones.
Doctor, when I look at this chart, I'm seeing you say that the total tax expenditures for the income fiscal year 2013 is at $4.7 billion. But your 71% indicates significant administrative problems to change it. That would be $3.3 billion of the $4.7 billion.
That's correct.
And
yeah.
That would include some of the federal issues and some of the other complexity. And does it also include the interactions?
Madam Chair, the interactions are actually taken out in the four, before you get to 4.7. I took those out because in some sense, if you got rid of all of them, you'd have those. So the big interactions I took out. But there would be some other interactions that would complicate. And some interactions are positive, some are negative. If you actually did this, some people would be pushed up into a higher tax bracket. So you have some reasons why it could grow, too, as well as shrink. So it's probably a pretty good number. The 4.7 is not an overstatement of what it would be. But you're right. The significant administrative problems is basically the timing issues and the informational issues that we could face. And, again, I don't want to say none of those can be done because they can be. It's just that they all have some problems. Now, if you look at the corporate tax, you have a very different picture in the corporate tax. Corporate tax on the next page, we collect $889 million in fiscal year, we expect to, in fiscal year 2013. And the tax expenditures for that year are $828. That's 93% of collections. And the big difference here is most of these tax expenditures in the corporate tax area are not timing issues and are not informational issues. In fact, there are really no informational issues in terms of the tax expenditures for that. So you're really looking at 85% of these as being feasible administratively without any particular difficulty. 79% of collections are the ones that are feasible. Now, feasible doesn't mean anybody would do them. Okay, one of these is the 100% sales apportionment. which by then will be 100% sales apportionment. And so realize that when we say repeal or post fewer no administrative problems, some of these may be ones that nobody wants to touch, but they're in there. Okay, everything else would be $703 billion. And that would be enough to lower the corporate rate from about, if you did all that, you could lower the corporate rate at the bottom here from 9.8% down to maybe 5.3, something like that, if you did them all. And that's assuming nothing else in terms of interactions, in terms of changing behavior of corporations. But you could lower that, you could drop that rate a lot, okay, if you in fact did that. And that's without decoupling from any federal timing issues at all. So that's simply doing the Minnesota type of stuff. Finally, for sales tax, I just want to real quickly note, for sales tax, we have another problem. And the Tax Expenditure Review Commission study talked about this. And last year, you had a few tax expenditures that you added, and then you said, but we don't consider this a tax expenditure. And those were sales tax exemptions for business products. I think one had to do with mining equipment, grinding equipment. And there was something in that that said, we don't consider this to be a tax expenditure. And it was because it's a tax break. The tax expenditure budget includes some tax expenditures in the sales tax area, which are deductions for business. Now, some of those are very narrowly targeted and might, in fact, be sort of such special treatment that they might, you might consider those to be tax expenditures in some sense. But for capital equipment and business services, a business is generally the final user of the product or the service. And so those are included, they have been included in the study from the beginning. Some states don't include them. Okay, so just be aware, this is a question, should they be considered tax expenditures? But the tax expenditure budget has a lot of them. Reformers who define the sales tax as a consumption tax and say it ought to be taxed on consumption generally would oppose a lot of the repeal of a lot of these business-related sales tax exemptions. So there is this question, are you taxing consumers or are you taxing consumers and business? And everyone's going to have a different perspective on it, but the tax expenditure budget assumes that it does include those business, the benefits to business of exemptions for capital equipment type of stuff and anything else specific to the specific ones. So a lot of them are business. The second thing is the tax expenditure budget also excludes a lot of services. We don't include medical services. We don't include educational services. We don't include housing services. The fair tax would tax rents that people pay on housing. That's not included in our tax expenditure budget. And construction services are also not included. They could be, but they are not in there. So in some ways, there are even more tax expenditures you could define out there than we have done in the services area, and they're not in there. So the total may understate things on the consumer side for that reason as well.
Doctor, can you just comment on the second point under the sales tax and businesses? What you're talking about now are the inputs or the cost of making the product that businesses engage in. And if we taxed them, it would increase the cost of doing business and the price of producing. Is that what you're talking about there?
Madam Chair, Minnesota generally gives a deduction for a lot of for things that are used in the process of production.
Right.
And that's not considered tax expenditure in the tax expenditure budget because the business is not the final purchaser in that case. They're purchasing something to create something else. But the tax expenditure budget includes capital equipment. So think of it as being capital equipment and business services. But business services, if a business buys services and then produces something, that also would increase costs, et cetera. But that's included in the tax expenditure budget. And some would say it shouldn't be, and some would say it should be. But that's how the study has been done since 1985, and we haven't changed that rule. But most business, when you think about business inputs that are used in the process of production, those are not considered tax expenditures in the budget.
I'm trying then to understand your second point. Can you give me an example of one of the sales tax exemptions other than the capital equipment that you talked about in your first point?
You've got capital equipment, farm equipment, repair of farm equipment, telecommunications equipment, a bunch of other things that are sort of capital equipment-like. You have data center inputs, data center stuff, building materials for data centers. That would be included in here. We also, any construction materials for light rail, for example, that's not business, but it's sort of business, and that again is would be included as a tax expenditure in here. So construction exemption on construction materials would tend to be, because the person who buys that, you don't sell that to somebody else. You don't use it. You basically are selling the final product, so that tends to be included in it as well.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Same thing for sales tax that we looked at before. In sales tax, we have about $5 billion collected in expected in fiscal year 2013 on the November forecast. Tax expenditures total $6.5 billion, the ones that are included in the study. And again, that doesn't include the ones that were listed at the bottom of the previous page that we don't include. And so you got $6.5 billion of tax expenditures, only $5 billion of collections. So tax expenditures are 130% of collections. And if you only included the tax expenditures that are for purchases by consumers, you're still at 60% of collections. And so there's a lot of room for expanding, even for those who think this should be a consumption tax. There certainly is a lot of room for expansion for anybody who wanted to bring business tax, business inputs in as well. But purchases for business are about half, and consumer purchases are about half of the tax expenditures listed in the book. So if you're somebody who says, no, we shouldn't be increasing the tax on business, but those things should be exempt, I still would say look at individual ones. Some of those things are so narrowly defined that they probably create an unlevel playing field that you might want to consider it anyway. But as a general proposition, some people would say leave those out. You're still leaving it. This, you know, base broadening has potential, the bottom it says, to reduce the rate from 6.875 to below 4.5%, even if base expansions were limited to consumer goods and services and limited to consumer services listed under the, including the tax expenditure budget, so not medical, not construction, not the other ones listed on that page. Again, you've got a lot of room for base expansion in the sales tax, no matter how you do it. I would say that if you did this tax change and you lowered the rate to 4.5%, remember that every business that's paying sales tax on their inputs would be paying a lower rate. There'd be a large benefit to business if you did this because you're expanding on consumers and you're lowering the rate, but the lower rate also applies to everything that's taxable by businesses. So, anyway, so basic conclusion is, that may be a good place to stop. I'm not sure about time. I do have just a few warnings on a page about those who just look at this as a way to raise money, ways to raise revenue. The revenue perspective, caution using the tax expenditure budget as a menu of alternatives, that is an appropriate use. I don't want to say that's inappropriate in any way. I'm just saying caution. When you look at these numbers, they're not revenue estimates, and in some cases they may be misleading. Unlike revenue estimates, tax expenditure estimates ignore interactions among provisions. They ignore any interaction with another tax. They don't adjust for effective dates. And the most important one under effective dates is anything dealing with timing, you should not look at the tax expenditure budget as a revenue estimate. It'll be way off. If it's a timing issue, the whole way a tax expenditure budget is done, the tax expenditure budget says, if we had been doing this from eternity, how much more would we be getting this year? Not how much we'd be getting if we started taxing something differently today. So on timing issues, you really have to be aware of these estimates. They're done correctly from a tax expenditure budget perspective, but on accelerated depreciation or anything timing, be careful, be cautious. You'll get a very different number from a tax expenditure if you try to do those. They don't generally take collectability into account, so the sales tax exemption for publications, that's magazine subscriptions. We know that when we do a revenue estimate for that, we say, well, a lot of these companies don't have Nexus in Minnesota, and the revenue estimate comes in lower than the tax expenditure number. This doesn't apply to a whole bunch, but it applies to some. Magazines is the best example I can think of. And remember, these are only updated every 2 years, so they do get out of date. So a year from now, you know, things will be very different than they may look today in terms of the numbers. And again, the administrative complexity should be remembered in every case when you look at these as a menu. If something really isn't administrable, there's not really, you got to really think about whether you want to propose that in that case. And I will conclude there. Just I think this is useful. Study can be useful in a lot of different ways. I think if you're interested in tax reform or budget reform, it's a starting place for a lot of the analysis. But you should be cautious in using the numbers and understand the limitations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And, Doctor, we'll be looking for a little bit more information as we discuss today. I appreciate that. I know the members will be interested as well. Senator Boxer.
Madam Chair, my example about Dr. Wilson's comment about using caution is the de minimis, the $700 de minimis on the use tax. scores a significant amount of revenue in the tax expenditure budget, but if you actually ask Dr. Wilson to do a revenue estimate on how much money that will raise, it looks radically different than what you see in the tax expenditure report.
I'm Chair, Senator Bach, that's exactly correct, although if we could just get some action in Washington, D.C. on the streamline bill, then it would raise that much money.
Right. Well, and you're singing Senator Rust's song over there, Doctor, I think. Well, members, we are done for today, but we have no hearing on Tuesday. That's my Valentine for you all, February 14th, no tax committee meeting at 8:30. Wednesday the 15th, we have an update from Kathleen Gaylord. She's the chair of the Property Tax Working Group. And we also will have Eric Naumann back to finish up his presentation on school finance. On Thursday the 16th, we'll have the fiscal disparity report presented by the Department of Revenue. And I have been asked by folks in the general public to come and testify. They're interested in that fiscal disparities report. So we will try and accommodate folks that want to be heard on that as well. So that's Wednesday and Thursday of next week. With nothing further before us, we are adjourned.